stop. Who child is time to jump in too wild? That's why we got more than two stops. Two and that in the situation, two shots. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive. And it's time to pull the next. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, predator and survivalist. Spitting heaven, fire from his lips. Burn a slave driver.
Welcome, listeners. The time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, it's ourradionetwork.com. We broadcast out of Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And before you leave that page, do me a favor and hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for Awakening Media is there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening. List interesting articles that you can read, download at later times to share with your friends, and also check out the Time for Awakening Marketplace in partnership with the BB Toomey. A lot of interesting things that you can purchase on the marketplace. Check it out and make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. 7:10 on Sunday evening. Tonight in the city of Philadelphia, and we're in Sunday open forum. No guests scheduled this Sunday, which is kind of rare. We did have a guest tentatively scheduled, but he'll be appearing in Philadelphia in September. So what we're going to do, we're going to kind of switch it around and kind of billboard him before he comes to town, and I'll let you know who that guest is in the coming weeks. But he was scheduled to be on with us, but we kind of switched things around. So it's open forum tonight with the listeners of Time for Awakening. Anything that's on your mind, you can give us a call, throw it out there, topic of conversation, and we'll talk about it. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go and what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot, Sundays 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street, Brother Richard. Is with us, Brother Richard.
Yes, sir.
How are
yes,
you,
sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I'm looking forward to this. Since we have this space, this opening, see what the Time for Awakening audience have to bring up, and possibly what you have scheduled to get us energized and in that problem solving, thought provoking mode. you always find these things that open us up to see how interconnected things are as it relates to the Black world.
Yeah, so, I'm glad you give me credit, Richard. I ain't no different than any of you or the listening audience. A couple of things, man. On a lighter note, you see it didn't got cooled off, Richard. It's in the 80s, so I know that you're a little upset about that. Richard? Okay, that's a little technical difficulties here. Richard, you still there?
Oh, yeah. Oh, here I go. I was saying, I hope there's no indication that summer's over, because it was nice. I mean, it was mild and whatever, but I did feel the breeze. And I said, wait a minute now, does that mean we already moving into September, October? I hope that's not so. And the summer is over. It seems summer goes fast. I mean, winter seems to linger, but summer goes fast. I hope that that's not the case.
Yeah, I know this has been the wettest weather, spring, summer. I mean, this has been the wettest weather.
Yeah.
I mean, I can ever remember. They said this is the wettest on record for the state of Pennsylvania. But, you know, just period. Looking at the weather around this country, it's something happening.
Oh, yeah.
It's clear that the Earth is making change. I'm talking about the physical planet that we live on. And it's time for our people, being that our ancestors was in tune with what was going on with the planet. And it's clear that they were in tune with a lot of things going on, that we start realizing it's time to change. Mm. And the change takes place first in the mind.
Definitely.
When our ancestors first came here, it was necessary for the enslavers and captors to change the minds of our people and start developing a different mindset, whether they use religion, whether they use the whip and gun, whatever sources that, and whether they denied our ancestors' education for hundreds of years, whatever sources that they use or tools, quote unquote, tools at their disposal, they needed to change the minds of our people. So we would be more acceptance of our circumstances and situation, and more accepting to them. Which I think really is more key, that they exactly. Being more accepting to them. And you look now, and that's still a point of contention among some of our people, our mindset and our mindsets towards our former enslavers and captors, because now we're not in physical bondage anymore, at least the majority of us. But the thing that there is our minds. It still holds that affinity of that former chattel enslavement, and that physical captivity is still present in some of our minds. I think I'm getting a little interference in the background. I don't know. That might be my mic. Hopefully it's mine. Richard, I want to play a clip by Professor Lumumba. I think he's at the Dar es Salaam University over there on the continent. And he makes references to something that I think it might kind of have some bearing on something I just mentioned about the mindset of our people.
I really like his presentation and how he delivers, for how Africans in the diaspora should look at things. I think he does a very good job.
Well, his analysis is spot on. And that's what's needed now. You find some of our ancestors in the struggle, they always kind of critically thought about our situation and whether their methods was could be criticized now, looking back in history. That's another story. But they always try to look critically at our situation and ways to move our people to get out of it. If you look at some of our ancestors that made an impact, Richard, they was never talking about how they were going to free themselves or how they were going to do well for themselves or their immediate family. All these ancestors we're talking about always looked out for the masses of black people, people they didn't even know. Hey, come on, Richard, that mindset in itself is totally foreign, not only to Europeans, but totally foreign to some of us, and especially now. Men that risked their lives. Go ahead, Richard. Go ahead.
No, I was just saying individualism.
Yeah, I mean, that mindset didn't come from us. We developed it. We fostered it. And I mean, some of us buy into it lock, stock, and barrel. But a lot of these men that we're talking about, that we talk about sometimes on this program, that any of us can pick up a history book and read about, a lot of their mindset was, I mean, they put their lives on the line for our children and children's children, people they didn't even know. They was concerned about them. Even when our ancestors were enslaved, you had people up here in northern areas that weren't directly enslaved. They were still enslaved, but they weren't on a plantation. But you can see through their writings, through their letters, through some of the historical communications that we can read about now, that they was concerned about their brothers and sisters that were enslaved. And they used all their energies to try to do something about their situation.
That's
true. I mean, I rarely read, and I'm quite sure that, you know, that mindset always had existed here because it was fostered by Europeans. But I haven't read, Richard, where somebody was openly critical or sided with Europeans in relation to the situation that our people lived under. I mean, now you see a lot of people, whether it's Clarence Thomas, Candace Owens. I mean, the list goes on and on. You can get a bunch of these people now. Some of these pastors that go down there and meet with Trump, Martin Luther King's niece. You can get a lot of these people that say all kind of crazy stuff in reference to our situation here, to white supremacy, so-called white supremacy, and the people that are backers of it, whether it's Trump or whoever. They make statements and openly in favor of some of these people, but I rarely ran across any people that did that type of thing when our ancestors were enslaved.
Not supportive of being of slavery itself and or human bondage in any shape, in general, in principle. I haven't either. Not to that degree. Now, there may have been, we'd hear people who've made some, personal sacrifices. I'm the only one to call it sacrifice. Took personal advantage within the context of the moment that they lived in, that might have seemed like, they were looking out for themselves over the others. I can see that in the historical narrative, but even those didn't say bondage, human bondage, we call enslavement, was a good thing, you know. Or at least those men and women aren't on record. Even if the record was written by white men and women, they didn't record that those sentiments were a prevailing sentiment of any individual that thought that about a people's situation, that was the place that we should be. I may be wrong, and the listening audience may know some, but I haven't seen any, in the little scan that I've seen. So your point is well valid.
You know, one person that kind of comes to mind, and not in that vein, so to speak, because he's not in that vein that I'm talking about, like the mindset we see now of a Clarence Thomas or others. But the one that they did the movie about maybe a couple of years ago, Solomon Northrup, they did their movie 12 Years a Slave. Now, he was a businessman. I think he lived in New York at the time, Bridget.
No, Philadelphia.
Okay. And doing business. And doing business with both white and black folks.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of, you can just, if you look at him and view his writings and just close your eyes and kind of envision him, you can see that he didn't really see himself as necessarily a black man until he ended up in captivity. Because he took that meeting with the two white guys that ended up enslaving him through that Fugitive Slave Act, and he wasn't even a fugitive slave. They was just grabbing black people and using it for their advantage to sell them. And he ended up down in New Orleans. I think he was sold in a couple other places. But after he got out, he wrote about his experiences in slavery. Now, the people that got him out, according to some writings, they didn't really believe that Douglas was a slave because of Douglas's intelligence, his writing style, his delivery. They didn't really like Douglas that much from some writings. And they wanted somebody else that they knew had been involved in captivity. So he was the perfect guy as far as they was concerned. So you see, other people was instrumental in getting him out of captivity. But once he got out, Richard, he kind of disappeared back into anonymity. He didn't get involved. It was people during that period, his period, Martin Delaney, Frederick Douglass, Henry Highland Garnett, Harriet Tubman a little bit later. It was people, especially during that period, that was heavily involved. If he wanted to, he could have really gotten involved in trying to be instrumental in freeing some of his brother. But, I mean, he was interested in getting out of that situation himself. And, you know, once he got back, he wrote that, book kind of catalog and his memoirs of his experience. But other than that, he disappeared in anonymity. You didn't see any more about him. He didn't have the mindset of some of these other people. That's a mindset that's not to be taken lightly. You know, over the years, you hear people being critical of a lot of our ancestors, even King of recent years, critical of his strategy that he developed. And you could see that he really didn't buy totally into it. But those men were doing that because they wanted to do something to free their brethren. Anybody to get their house bombed, or the wife, family threatened, and then they keep on doing the things that they were doing, he could have easily just started being a minister like his father was a popular minister. He could have went on and developed that career, and I'll use that term career because a lot of these people now, that's a career to them. He could have went on and just been a minister out there, touring from city to city, hooping and hollering and raking in money. But he decided to put his life on the line and end up losing his life, you know, to help his brothers and sisters. Malcolm the same way. And Malcolm wasn't a Christian minister. He's a Muslim minister. But I'm talking about the mindset. That's all I'm dealing with. I ain't talking about whether they was Muslim, Christian, whatever, or didn't believe in anything. They believed in trying to help their brothers and sisters by any means necessary, including the loss of their own physical life. But I just want to play a couple of these clips. I want to get your opinion on what he's saying here, Richard. I think take a little critical, and it's brief clips. It's not long. But I think he said something important in these couple of brief clips here that we need to take a look at. And he's talking about the people on the continent when he's mentioning this. But whether we realize it or not, that mindset is more in common with our people on the continent and here than what we understand in the narratives that Europeans try to feed both people on both continents about, you're different, they're this, they're that. You know, we got to start tabling those type of foolish thoughts because the same puppet master is on both shores and develop both of the systems that both people live under, whether you're on the continent or here. So I just want to, go ahead. You want to say something?
No. The only thought I would add is that in relationship to men and women, of course, there are men and women in prison now that's been in prison 40, 50 years that we don't even know. We may not even know the names of who took that same type of courageous stance for our people, you know, coming out of the Black Liberation Army. You know, have shot of Secordas in Cuba. So, you know, your point again is, you know, valid as far as what people do. So it's definitely fruitful to hear what Brother Lumumba has to say.
Yeah, it's just a couple of brief clips, but I'm looking at the mindset of what he's trying to talk about here. Let me pull up one and then I'll play the other.
You do within your systems in the political arena to begin to energize processes. One must ask, for example, here in the East African region, what are we doing to ensure that in this region we think as one? I fly from Nairobi 1 hour, 5 minutes, and I now have to grapple with Tanzanian shilling. My Kenyan shilling becomes suddenly useless. I leave Tanzania, I go to Burundi, I grapple with the Burundian franc. I leave Burundi, I grapple with the French, with the Rwandese franc. I go to Uganda, I'm grappling with the Ugandan shilling. I move upstairs, I'm dealing with the pound. I move to Angola, I'm dealing with the Kwanza. 55, almost 50 currencies, which are effectively useless. Because even the leaders don't believe in them. When the Sudanese head of state is arrested and they search his house, you don't find the Sudanese pound. You find the American dollar. And you find the euro. We also don't have faith in our own currencies. And our currencies are going to remain weak as long as we are not united. So in the East African region, what can we do? I travel. And I get to Julius Cameron.
Now, keep that in mind, Richard, what he's, the question that was asked there. Let me play this clip.
Permit me to say at this stage that Africa deals with diversity much better than Europe. Much better. If you look at your typical European nation, the Dutch is the Dutch, largely. The Swedes are the Swedes, largely. The Norwegians are the Norwegians, largely. The Finns are the Finns, largely. And where they have many ethnicities, they don't do very well. Ask the Spaniards, if you doubt me. Where they had many nations in Yugoslavia, ask them. They created many nations to create pure ethnicities. But African nations have succeeded thus far in working with diversity in very unique circumstances where the conceptual West, despite their protestation to the contrary, are always interfering in our affairs in a very subtle manner. When we are holding election, they will deny it. But there is a way in which they are always moving in a subterranean fashion. Because the thesis still is that you divide them in order to rule them. That is the thesis. We don't say it as loudly as we should because we want to be politically correct, and I refuse to be correct. And this is exactly what Kwame Nkrumah warned us about. Africa's long-term salvation demands that we avoid adversarial politics. Africa's salvation demands that we define for ourselves what democracy means. What people want is to participate. What people want is to have a government that is accountable. Many people in many African countries simply want food on the table. Many people in many African countries simply want to have access to health care. Many people simply want good education. Young men and women in Africa simply want opportunities for innovation and invention. And they want a government that creates an environment where that can be achieved. And therefore, in my view, I think the time has come that Africa must define herself. One of the problems that we have in Africa is that we do not define ourselves. And permit me to annoy you. In many African nations today, after every election, whether we like it or not, we have observers. And when the elections are being held, observers may come from Nigeria, from Kenya, from Uganda, but people are waiting. What did the European Union say? You know, this belief by us that the Europeans have a divine duty to tell us what to do, and we have a divine duty to accept to do what they say, is one of the problems that we have. And until the day that we liberate ourselves to decolonize our minds, in a manner of speaking, we are going to embrace the kind of politics that will only perpetuate conflict.
Regent.
Yes.
Now, I know that you picked up on what he was trying to bring out in both of those things. Okay. A couple points I want to make mention of first, because in both of those clips, he's talking about changing our minds, renewing our minds. In that first one, he talked about what can they do in his region where he is, at Dar es Salaam University, East Africa, to start thinking as one. You heard him mention that. And he used...
Yeah.
He used, when he was talking about the currency, that when he moves to different regions, it's different currencies. And they don't even have faith in the currencies that they have as a people. Because he said when something happens and they go into some of these leaders' houses, they have the euro and the franc. I mean, the euro and the American dollar. So they have more faith in those European currencies than their own. Then in the others, he was talking about politics. And that we have to change, that the people have to change their mind from the adversarial politics of their former captors to something else. And he was talking about defining themselves. Richard, mm-hmm. In both of those clips, he's talking about the changing of our minds and the changing of the way we do things, not based on what Europeans say, because he said that they're always moving in a subterranean fashion. You heard him say that.
Right.
To keep our people separate. And they have been very successful at doing it.
And bringing in surrogates, too.
Well, listen, he talked about the elections that they have. And in those countries, they're always concerned about what did the United States say? What did Europe say? He made mention of that. Subconsciously, what is that saying about the mindset? And see, that the thing is, Richard, that's clear. That mindset doesn't exist with just people on the continent, brothers and sisters on the continent. It exists here. We don't know how to define ourselves. And I want to say we, because it's people out there that's trying to do it. But on a whole, a lot of our people are looking towards these politicians, both white and black, to define them, to tell them what to do, to give them suggestions or solutions to these problems, and it's not going to happen.
Even prop them up, try to prop them up as their I'm gonna call it chess piece. That's supposed to give them power.
Repeat that again. I didn't catch all what you said.
Even prop them up as far as making them chess pieces, like propping up white politicians, whether they're male or female, in order for them to be the ones to solve our problems. You know, they look at it and that they can do it because we can't do it.
Yeah, well, you know, this is what, because there's a couple other things I wanted to throw into the pot here in relation to that. Because, go ahead.
Because it's interesting you brought that up, because for those of you know, been following the Time for Awakening postings, one thing that has been posting is, and this being August, and we're moving towards Garvey's birthday of August 17th. You know, I been posting snippets of Look for Me in the Whirlwind. And when you talk about mindset, I can, you know, before you go into the next piece, I want to this, what Garvey said, this 1924, that relates directly to what Lumumba said and to what you're presenting us, if you don't mind.
No, go ahead.
He said, the Negro man, we must represent the new Negro. His back is not yet against the wall. We do not want his back against the wall because that would be a peculiar and desperate position. We do not want him there. It is because asking for a fair compromise. While the Belgians have control of the Belgian Congo, which they cannot use, they have not resources to develop, nor the intelligence. The French have more territory than they can develop. There's certain parts of Africa in which they cannot live at all. So it is for you to come together and give us a United States of Africa. We are not going to be a race without a country. God never intended it. And we are not going to disappoint God's confidence in us as men. We are men, human beings, capable of the same acts as any other race, possessing under the fair circumstances the same intelligence as any other race. Now, Africa's been sleeping, not dead, only sleeping. Today, Africa is walking and around not only on our feet, but on our brains. You can enslave us for some 300 years, the bodies of men. You can shackle the hands of men. You can shackle the feet of men. You can imprison the bodies of men, but you cannot shackle or imprison the minds of men. Raise up, black men, and take your stand. Reach out, black men and women, and pull all nature's knowledge to you. Turn ye around and make a conquest of everything north and south, east and west, and then you will have wrought well. You will have merited God's blessing. You will become God's chosen people, and naturally you'll become leaders of the world. And as you bow down to white men today, so others bow down to you and call you a race of masters because of the intelligence of your mind and your achievement. No race has the last word on culture and civilization. They do not know what we're capable and thinking in they do not know what we're thinking. They're thinking in terms of dreadnoughts, battleships, airplanes, and submarines. You know what we're thinking about. That is our own private business. So give us credit for being able to use our minds. And once people are in concept of themselves, determined to use their minds, you cannot know to what extent they can go. Liberate the minds of men, and ultimately you will liberate the bodies of men. Now that's 1924, Marcus Garvey. Look for me in the whirlwind. This is 2019, and isn't Lumumba, and he made reference to Kwame Nkrumah saying about Africa being one, north, south, east, and west, by liberating the minds, and as you say, thinking as one, defining ourselves politically, and what does that mean as it relates to democracy, and that we are already dealing than any other European world. I mean, even today, America's having challenges supposedly dealing with diversity. So Garvey said then, liberate your mind. And I take that's the point that you're making.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, it's good that you threw that in because it was very timely in reference to this. All of these problems, you know, some of our people look at the situation we face and see that, you know, and you can see by the way some of them talk when they reference our task that we face, that this thing is insurmountable. And, you know, they don't know whether they'll see the solution in our lifetime, but maybe our children's children. You know, it's like this is so far off. But all it's going to take is a mindset change. And that can happen in a generation, Richard. But you need serious people that are among the people in leadership positions. And when I say leadership, I'm not referring to this crap that we see now. I'm not. Because when we listen, I'm not even talking that long ago. When you're talking about Malcolm or Martin, they weren't political leaders at all. They were grassroots community leaders. Some of them was leaders because they were religious leaders. But I'm talking about leaders among the people. They can push the people to develop a mindset. You asked Friday about what's going to be the, or what you asked the question about what can be the rallying point for this generation.
Right.
Just like, you know, when we talk about our ancestors coming out of that period of chattel enslavement into that period of what they consider the Reconstruction, the mindset of all of our ancestors almost was the same. We wanted freedom.
Okay.
And you asked the defining moment of now, and you suggested it could be repair. Because you
reparations.
Exactly. Because you see that's on the mind of our people. It's always been on the mind of our people here, but now it's developed into other people jumping on, and there's no problem. But you see around the world, wherever our people have been colonized or held in captivity, that mindset is starting to come to fruition. And strategies have been developed. Out of that World Conference on Racism, it's strategies that were developed that have been utilized by some of our brothers and sisters in other parts of the world. The thing is, this man, you keep in mind what Professor Lumumba said, and other people have said the same thing, that these people move in a subterranean fashion. They're always thinking. They always want to be one step ahead of you. We mentioned yesterday of what I consider frivolous things. The man is always trying to, when we mentioned about how they want to change the mindset of young blacks coming out of college into these professional ranks.
Right.
And all of a sudden they pass a ruling, a NCAA in conjunction with the NBA, that in order to be Asian to represent these guys, because they've been getting other young black guys with no college, just their friends, Rich Paul and others, to represent high-powered black athletes. All of a sudden, you got to have a college degree, pass a test, work 3 years in the NBA, and get bonding insurance. They want to make sure that you don't start getting some of these young blacks, that every way, in every way, they want to stay one step ahead of you. Well, they did the same thing in this issue of repair and reparations.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, it's a topic of conversation among these white politicians. They could care less about any repair and reparations for black folks. Pelosi, Bernie Sanders, all these people, they didn't care nothing about no reparations for blacks. They always wanted reparations for Jews. I think we read a couple of weeks ago where he pushed for some of these Jews to be repaired when that company was trying to get business down there in Maryland. And
right.
they found out that they had moved some Jews to concentration camps in the 30s and 40s. So they wanted that company to pay reparations. Tens of millions of dollars, maybe close to $1 billion. And they did it before they got their contract. So he's always been in favor of those reparations. But then he goes to a place like the NAACP and say that he's not in favor of it, and they give him a rousing standing ovation. It leaves you to scratch your head, like, what the hell? What's the matter with some of our people? But this is going to be the right. Go ahead.
And I like that, the delegation that went to Ghana. For the return, this is the 400 years, and becomes the spokesperson that's speaking to the president of Ghana. Isn't it Nancy Pelosi?
Yeah.
Who goes with, just a couple of weeks ago as a part of that. And you would think, it's just to the point that you're making, because now that, what Lumumba was talking about, because the AU they call it historical in the sense of creating a unified trade agreement amongst the 53 countries of Africa, which is the first time that they, so that they could be able to, and there's some observations, if not criticism, of whose interest that is, but it's definitely speaking to what Mumba was talking about when he was saying, you know, could that move towards what you're talking about, an AU currency that can be utilized to as a medium of exchange through different countries. And then what we have on the year of return, Nancy Pelosi and the delegation with John Lewis going to Ghana, to Almena, and feeling harmful. Well, what is the symbolism of that? Or should we look at the symbolism of that?
Well, I think it goes directly to what Professor Lumumba said about always wanting a European a nod or an approval. I mean, what the hell does that? Come on, man. Some of that stuff makes you angry when you see, you know, blacks that claim that they represent black folks doing stuff like that. They don't take you over to their holy shrines over there in Jerusalem and talk about making policy for no Jews. Well, they wouldn't even know their holy shrines, the land that they have annexed and call their holy land.
Mm-hmm.
And take you, you don't see them saying that they don't want you making no policy for them. They don't even want you involved in no type of policy making for them or nobody else for that matter. Who else does that?
And that
only points to what the man is saying, Richard. That only points to it. What the hell? You need their approval for you to move towards trying to restore your people, restore our dignity and honor, to get repair for our ancestors? You need these people involved in that? To that extent? A decision making on how you're going to move? Get out of here. Nobody else does that.
And which raises the question that we have to deal with in relationship to looking, and I always use that metaphor, Richard King always tells, to look at the chessboard, you know, on the black side of the chessboard, you know, because as that example of, because there's some black folks, and I think that you know, when you was using 12 Years a Slave, he took himself off the table. But there's some black folks that are looking for and been talking about a unified Africa, not for the installment of Africa for the Africans, but to the continuation of Africa to be controlled by Europeans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we have to you know, be conscientious of that. So when, you know, using that example of the delegation, even if because most of the people who were a part, besides Pelosi, she was Miss Ann was the only one there, right? The head of the Democratic Party,
mm-hmm.
right? The rest of them was people of color, and they had John Lewis, you know, Mr. Ibn Hiddicket Saad Lewis, you know, civil rights leader. I mean, that clarion call, you know, that unifying moment there and on this return. But is that Africa for Africans? When we here at home is questioning the Democratic Party, and what have we been getting out of it for our allegiance for over what? 60 or so years, and now that we're asking for repair and from this government, from the perspective of some of us, from a sovereign thinking perspective, not just let us get a check, but let us control our own destiny, let us control our children's destiny, and let it be based off of what was done to us, that we have the sovereign right to control our destiny, not be told how much I think one of the presidential nominees for the Democratic Party was saying, $100 million offering. I think her name is Williamson.
I'm not even sure.
That, and she's the most consistent reparations, again, a white woman who's been the most consistent saying that reparations is due as a part of this Democratic, nominational, because we're now galvanizing around it. But I'm just raising a point that we got to be careful of the black folks who are sounding just like us. But their agenda is different.
Certainly. And they bear watching. You know, when I seen her over there with that delegation of so-called black misleadership class, I'll use the term that Black Agenda Report uses, it harkens back to right after Nat Turner was captured and executed, and Virginia changed their policy, which spread to other countries in that early Union, that they wouldn't have blacks in religious meetings unless whites were present. Mm. So you see now where if it's any hint of any policy direction or movement of, whatever it is on a global scale, whites need to be present. She was there. And to be honest, she didn't have to be there, because just like when some of the other ancestors had their meetings, it was blacks present that would go right back and tell whites on the plantation exactly what was going on.
Yeah.
So that mindset, that's why it's more important for our people to really be serious if we're talking about moving our people forward. This adversarial politics that we've adopted from these Europeans, it don't work for us. None of this stuff works for us. We try to use it. You know, it's like clothes that don't fit. When you walk down the street, you look stupid. You got pants or shirts on that don't really fit. You're wearing clothes, but they don't fit. Well, this stuff don't really fit our people. And you can see it in the behaviors that come out. This stuff don't fit our people. It doesn't work for our people. I remember we had the sister on that wrote the book about integration being a failed experiment. If you take a critical assessment of the things we've been doing since we've been here, you can see that it's not working and it don't fit. Richard, I want to share something with the listening audience. I'm going to take a brief break. And when we come back, get on the phone and be part of the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're in open forum this evening on Time for an Awakening, which is kind of rare for Sunday, but it's no problem. You can always get involved in the conversation. I want to share this. And this is an old article, Richard. And when I say old, it's 7 years old. But I'm talking about what's contained in the article that I think is important. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an Awakening with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customer staff or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. And just mention you heard this special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me have held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. Amen. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be wrecked, if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
I'm not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP or the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the Slave Theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we are black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put him anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Let me just say this before our time winds up. And that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lorne Green sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:12 in the city of Philadelphia, and we're in open forum here on a Sunday program, which is rare. You can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Richard, it's kind of ironic that we've been talking about this, and we play that clip where everybody in that particular clip, Miss Cynthia McKinney, has become an ancestor.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all talking about changing our mindset. All talking about it. All talking about it. King talked about in the first one that we put faith in people that who too often have proved to be unfaithful. That was King. Nobody else. Mm-hmm. King said that. He said they were booing me because I did that. He took onus. He took that responsibility.
Mm.
He said their hopes had soared when I told them, let's try this strategy. He said they're now booing me because I told them to have faith in people that had too often have been unfaithful. What did he say? Faith in white society and people that who too often have been unfaithful. Those are the speeches, Richard, that they don't be playing for our young people to hear. They play the other one that he did in 63 before his mindset was changed. They need to listen to those type of speeches when he told the people, I'm sorry for what I did. He said, because we're on a collision course. The collision course has been set.
Mm.
I mean, those are his words. Go ahead, Richard. I'm sorry.
And I know it's just that, you know, and I my mind is still dealing with the, you know, as you bring up the leaders and how we should be from this, you know, sovereign thinking perspective, right? How we should be looking at that vision of, you know, and hopefully the listening audience don't get upset with me in the sense of from that repair. Because one thing that we wanted to do always was reconnect ourselves back to the continent, right? To make sure that the one of the aspects was to make us whole. And in making us whole was recognizing that we can do something here to show our sovereignty, but at the same time show our connectedness to the continent. Because we have to heal together in order to really have real power, right? And they recognize that clip that, you know, those men and women are saying, talking to us here of what we needed to do to be a sovereign people. And as you said, in a lot of cases, if it didn't cost them their life, well, Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney, I mean, the embarrassment that she had to go through in trying to assert that sovereign thinking, you know, the kind of thinking that you're talking about that we should have. And I'm emphasizing that because, and for those who, you know, want to know where that term, they should go to the, you know, the podcast and listen to. We done did a couple of interviews with Brother Al Ramon,
mm-hmm.
you know, to be able to hear what he enunciates and stuff. Because doesn't that speak to what you're saying as far as the way we should be thinking?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And wasn't that what they lost their life because they were thinking? Because when you're thinking from a sovereign perspective, you're not thinking for yourself, about your immediate family. even the generation that you're in. You're asking from the generations before to the generations to come. And our particular 400 years in this environment under captivity, did they want us to think about the generations before and the generations to come?
No, they don't want you to think independently of what's going to go on. They want you to accept your place as being a basically a permanent permanent underclass in this country. That's the place that that we're supposed to have in this country. It's no other place. I mean, look at it. Look at the situations that our people face even now. And where is it supposed to be heading? I just critically think about our situation, Richard. The schools in these cities are closing down. There's no jobs, no, contrary to that crap that they put out, these employment figures, because they don't put out how many of these so-called jobs are living wage jobs. No employment. The education is in the tank. No business opportunities in these communities where we dwell. The only thing that's busting at the seams is this prisons, this prison mm-hmm. industrial complex. Mm-hmm. That's growing year by year by leaps and bounds. So what is the ending of this story supposed to be if we just let things go as they are going? It's other people dictating the course of our people. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no. I apologize because I get excited because the points that you raised, because it's, you know, to show how it is yet, you know, again, shown, because this thing is so, and here we're talking about the 400 year and time where we're raising, I mean, amplifying, or let's say it's always been developing, you know, about reparations or repair, right? And it's being amplified in this moment in amongst this generation, and it's being co-opted. And we just gave an example of even the return. You got just one white woman, right? I mean, going with a delegation of people of African descent. I mean, Elha, she's, you know, directly out of Somali, East Africa, right? To show that, to control this, right? And, you know, I came across that a Senate Foreign Committee chairperson created a bill, H.R. 2116, this month, which is called the Global Fragility Act. Michael McCall, representative from Texas, and Elliot Engel, Michael McCall is a Republican, and Elliot Engel is a Democrat out of New York. Now, this Foreign Fragility, Global Fragility Act, and I'm reading an article, you know, where they're talking about how one way of looking at this here, and this ties into when we're talking about sovereignty, those men and women that you played talking about thinking, you know, the mistakes of not promoting and thinking more on our own. When the continent is talking about creating a global continental trade barrier, lessening the barrier and unification, which Garvey in 24 said we have to do in Washington. This is the article of that was in May 17th, the U.S. House Foreign Affairs Committee held a wide-ranging hearing Thursday focused on how the U.S. Agency for International Development, the Department of State, and the Department of Defense can coordinate African policies. One of our biggest policy challenges in sub-Saharan Africa is figuring out how to help stabilize fragile states and reduce violence. Over the past 20 years, we've learned a lot about what works and what doesn't. We know that it requires strategic vision. It takes an adequate long-term funding, and it takes coordinated coordination across United States government, says Representative Elliot Engel, a Democrat for the New York and the chairman of the committee. Now, this is the co-sponsor to this Global Fertility Act. And when you hear them talk about it, you'll hear them constantly bringing up about Africa. They done, it took them 20 years to create a strategic vision. While this generation is talking about unification, and here out of, they're creating acts for control. When they're telling us 2019 is a 400 years of our remembrance, what? Remembrance of being under English captivity? In the year of return, they're talking about, they're going with a contingent from Congress led by the Speaker of the House, Miss Nancy Pelosi. And as you said, she didn't have to go. And then here, sitting back here at the Senate, they're talking about, well, these are fragile states, so we need to create, out of the Senate now, we need to create a Global Fragility Act and help. Doesn't that mean to maintain control here and there?
And there, yeah. Yeah, but then we got, you know, there's collaborators involved in this. See, you know, we need to, until we get these people out, because we need to be developing these candidates now. I'm talking about among these communities to get these representatives out from in front of our people. But until we do, we need to have some type of, because when these incidents happen, you notice these white communities, they demand these politicians come before a town hall and they ask them tough questions. And the politicians show up. In some of these communities, when you ask to talk to the politicians, number one, you get the runaround. And when you do have a meeting with him, he sends a representative. He don't even come. They don't even have the respect of the community to show up themselves. We got to start demanding a different accountability from these people and ask them the tough questions. I want to go to...
That requires us thinking differently.
Well, exactly. I want to go to, look like Scotty is on the line,
yeah.
And I want to bring him on, but I want to read a couple, I want to read some of this article here, Richard, because it goes to directly what we're talking about. We brought it up the other week. I want to read this, and I want the listening audience to really grasp what this is saying. This article is 7 years old, but it's very relevant now. Because we can see the fruits of its relevancy. Put it that way. I'll term it that way. This is from a published report on October 27, 2012. It's called Pro-Israel Lobby Courts African Americans. Hezbollah is a Hebrew word for a particular type of pernicious propaganda first employed by early Zionist leaders to explain actions of the Jewish administration in Palestine. In recent years, Hezbollah has been disseminated by certain Christian fundamentalists who believe supporting Israel brings them closer to God, and also by many members of the United States Congress who have been co-opted by the powerful pro-Israel lobby. Now the lobby has set sights on a new group of potential collaborators, African Americans. A group of 18 African-American local and state politicians, including the presidents of city councils of Atlanta and Detroit, recently enjoyed a tour of Israel, courtesy of the American Israel Education Foundation, AIEF. AIEF is also sponsored by the infamous 2011 U.S. Congress Congressional Summer Trip to Israel, during which 81 American lawmakers diverted their attention from budget debate and U.S. financial crisis in order to focus on sightseeing and the pleasures in the Holy Land and to be courted by Netanyahu government. AIEF is a part of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC, the biggest pro-Israel lobby group in the U.S. Also, Christians United for Israel, CUFI, the largest non-Jewish pro-Israel organization in the United States, hosted a number of programs specifically targeted towards African-American religious communities. These events were held in black churches in New York and other cities across the country during CUFI's Gathering of Solidarity for the State of Israel's campaign. The AIEF political junket and the CUFI's church meetings are examples of the recent push to recruit pro-Israel support from among the African-American community. According to Nathan Gutman, in a recent article in the Jewish newspaper Forward, both CFUI and AIPAC have been developing contacts in the African-American community for at least 5 years, although their efforts has gone largely unnoticed until now. The Vanguard Leadership Group is an Atlanta-based AIPAC-supported group that offers leadership training to students at historically black colleges. Its founder and executive director, Jared Jordan, was the president of the 2008 AIPAC Policy Conference. There, he claims to have been inspired by a speech of then-president presidential candidate Barack Obama, which led him to create an African-American organization dedicated to improving African-American and Jewish relations and increase African-American support for Israel. Check it out, Richard. Now, follow along. Reverend Mark Stevens will be organizing the CUFI events in African-American churches. Stevens, who is an African-American pastor at the University City Church of God in Charlotte, North Carolina, first met John Hagee, the founder and national chairman of CUFI in 2007. Soon afterwards, Stevens became heavily involved in a pro-Israel Christian organization. In 2010, Hagee appointed Stevens to his current position of National African American Church Outreach Coordinator for the organization. Reverend Stevens stated in an interview that he has been told by God that his church should be a blessing to Israel, and that he, Reverend Stevens, told his parishioners from the pulpit. Told his parishioners from the pulpit that God wants our church, a black church, to support Israel. Interviews, Stephen criticizes black liberation theology for not doing their homework and disparages the comparison of Israeli policy in the West Bank and East Jerusalem to an apartheid regime in South Africa. The organized efforts to bring religious African-American Christians into the pro-Israel fold did not begin with CUFI and the appointment of Stevens to his present position. An African-American minister who is identified only as Evangelist Dora wrote an account in her 2009 trip to Israel during the Gaza War. The trip was sponsored by AIEF and called the African American Leader Mission. The tour was led by Christina King, the Midwest Outreach Regional Director, who, according to Dora, is a loving and kind Christian professional. Dora reports that she and her tour mates were served fabulous Mediterranean cuisine, prayed at the Wailing Wall, baptized in the Jordan River, sat in the midst of leaders and scholars absorbing Israel's history. She reports that she is internally grateful for this and have been the life-changing experience. Along with the food, Dora was served a generous helping of Israel's war propaganda, which led her to conclude that Hamas will go so far as to destroy their own and distort the truth of its actions. So Israel appears to be a ruthless, uncaring a nation. Whether groups like AIPAC or CUFI can convince enough African Americans to become pro-Israel zealots or to make their efforts worthwhile is open for discussion. Some of the African American community have a history of painting Israel as an oppressive white nation that subjugates brown people in Palestine. Attempts by Jewish organizations to pull back African Americans from this perspective were mostly unsuccessful in the past. In the past 10 years, we've witnessed a growing number of African Americans from an elite class who are willing to take public stances which oppose positions usually identified with civil rights movement and African American struggle against oppression. Herman Cain and arguably Barack Obama are examples of this phenomenon. If the pro-Israel lobby can recruit even a small number of influential African Americans to enlist in their war, while recruiting a significant number of fundamentalists from the African American church, the Jewish propagandists will reinforce by members of an ethnic group which have a unique standing in combating charges that Israel is an apartheid and racist state. These African Americans will not be believable to anyone but a bit of knowledge about Israel and Palestine. For the average African American, they would be told, well, excuse me, hold it, let me take this last paragraph again. These African Americans will not be believable to anyone with a bit of knowledge about Israel and Palestine. But for the average African American, they can be convincing. By showing strength among African Americans, a pro-Israel lobby will have demonstrated that it has power to co-opt members of a group that has traditionally not been supportive of American Jewish causes. So we see here from this article, 8 years old, Richard, that they've been actively recruiting what they consider the elite class of blacks. They're going to college campuses. They talk with church leaders and political leaders. It mentioned here city councils from Detroit, Atlanta, and other cities, state and local politicians. You remember when we talked about some of the local politicians here that took that junket to Israel?
Yeah.
And we see that there, this whole effort to cultivate Manchurian candidates. You've seen that movie before, The Manchurian Candidate.
Yeah.
This whole effort to co-opt, to cultivate Manchurian candidates from among black people is sinister at its best. We got to be aware of these strategies these people are using. We got to hold these Manchurian candidates accountable. Call them in. Ask them why are they supporting that's a foreign government. How are you supporting a foreign government over the needs of your own people here? And when I say your own people, I'm not talking about the American people. I'm talking about black people. That's who they represent.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
These are Manchurian candidates here. Look at the strategies that they're using. Taking them over there, giving them money, whining and dining them, showing them lavish. Come on, Richard. This is... Before I go to Scotty, let me just read this last paragraph, because it talked about this one that had been developed in Atlanta. You've seen that early on in that article I read. This is something, and this came from a Jewish paper, the AGI.org, and it's talking about the Atlanta Black Jewish Coalition. In 1982, a group of concerned citizens from Atlanta's black communities came together to campaign for the renewal of the Voting Rights Act, the drive to renew one of the most important pieces of the civil rights legislation in history, reinvigorated the bonds between the black and Jewish community. Those involved decided to create a coalition to ensure that dialogue and partnership between blacks and Jews would continue in Atlanta. Today, the Atlanta Black Jewish Coalition has emerged as a central platform for education, outreach, and advocacy. Participation reaches new heights. The coalition continues to build in its original mission by providing a forum for dialogue and action. Participants in the program is selective, and most Project Understanding alumni have continued to be leaders in various facets in the black community. Alumni include several corporate CEOs, many nonprofit leaders, a number of prominent political figures, including former mayor of Atlanta, Kasim Reed, and gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams. So you see the people that's coming out of this Manchurian candidate factory, Richard. Participation in the program is selective. According to the writing here, everybody can't get involved. They're choosing the right candidates, the right people, and putting them in quote-unquote positions of power, black people in positions of power. It says here that this organization is the alumni of this organization include several corporate CEOs, many nonprofit leaders, a number of prominent political figures. The Manchurian candidate, Richard. That's all I can say.
And that's just dealing with Israel.
Let's go exactly. Let's go to Scotty here in North Carolina. Hey, sir, what's happening?
Hey, what's going on? What's going on?
No,
I was calling in because you were talking about the politics of division. There's a number of things y'all touched upon on the subject of reparations. I heard from in Cobra, what's his name, Brother Jamoke, that they have more co-sponsors of H.R. 40 than they ever had before.
Yeah, I think it's up around 100 now, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and they were saying that, what's his name, Conyers, that was introducing it all those years, had told them that they needed at least 100 co-sponsors.
Exactly.
And now they had those co-sponsors. But there's still a couple of African-American representatives who still have not co-signed on to it. But, you know, looking at the reality of you know, the situation out there on the ground is it's not going to happen. It's not going to advance while Trump is still in office. It's just simply not. And as well as the Senate. When you got Zionists controlling the Senate, Zionist Republicans, and then you have your Zionist Democrats as well. But I think that's progress. I think that's a good sign that, you know, they've been able to lobby to get that many co-sponsors when you never had that many, you know, never before in the past. Now, where the fight is, though, where the main battle is, in my opinion, is to change public opinion. Now, I came across something that Barack Obama said, you know, because we often hear that Obama didn't support reparations. Well, it wasn't that he didn't support the ideal of reparations, but he didn't think it had a chance of passing. So therefore, he felt like it'd be a waste of his time politically. He said it didn't have a political, what would you call it? The political support in order.
Capital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, political capital. To advance that, okay? You know, you could argue with that, but at the same time, I could see where he's coming from. We do need to build public support for reparations and just continue to build upon, you know, this momentum. Again, 100 co-sponsors is no small thing for that bill, given that there is very little public support among the general populations for it. And I think it's because of miseducation. I think a lot of it is miseducation. They're not really educated on it. And then the other part is they're a bunch of racists, you know, and what happened.
And Scotty, isn't that the distinction, though, that the general support amongst white constituency is low, but amongst black constituency, support for reparation is above the 50th percentile?
Yes, yes, that's true, but we know that we make up a very small electorate. I mean, that's good, and it should be at 100. I don't see why any black person in their mind. Look, I was watching NPR. I saw an NPR segment. They had this black professor on who was anti-reparations. He works at Brown. He's a professor at Brown University. And his reasoning was, and this speaks to the elitism among our people, you know, as you were just reading about these elite blacks that Israel have been recruiting, you know, it kind of speaks to that as well. Man, I lost my train. I lost my train of thought, man.
You're talking about the guy down at Brown University. He said something. Brown. Yeah,
he was saying that he doesn't support it. Called, and this is his exact words. This is an exact quote. Because blacks like me have made it. So in other words, he's a tenured professor making probably six figures of how much ever professors make. He ain't really wanting for nothing. He ain't worried about making his rent next month or his car payment or his electric bill. I've got mine. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I think for too many people, man, you know, that's that elitism. That's that elitism within us. Now, going back to something else that y'all was saying, I want to use the example of the Justice Democrats. Have y'all ever heard of Justice Democrats?
No, I can't say that.
Okay. Justice Democrats are progressive Democrats who have been doing exactly what y'all said we need to do as black people need to do is recruiting their own candidates to run primaries against Democrats that's already in office.
That's part of the Young Turks.
Yes.
Yeah, that might be who you was talking about that wanted to come on the program, Richard, the new kind of Democrat. Go ahead, Scotty.
Yeah. And so I think that shows you right there that it is possible. We don't need to wait one or two generations or anything like that. The only thing that would be prohibitive I could see is if we don't fund the effort. You know, because the Justice Democrats is like a 501c4. They are a political organization, like a lobbying organization that supports progressive candidates. That's how they got Ilhan Omar is one of the ones that they supported. What's the Puerto Rican lady out of New York?
Cortez, her chief of staff. He's the chair of that Justice for Democrats.
Yeah, he's in a little bit of trouble right now, though. They're going after him saying he embezzled some money. I tell you, man, corruption will really destroy, you know, a well-intentioned movement. When you get corrupt people in there and they do stuff to personally enrich themselves, it harms the whole movement. But I was using them as an example of something that we need to do, you know, because I think John Lewis need to be primary. This man has been up there forever, and he has basically betrayed the legacy of the civil rights movement. He's pro-war, he's pro-Israel, he's pro-police, you know, and what have you. So I'm like, man, it's a lot of these people that need to be primaried. You know, this one woman here in Charlotte, you know, I live in a predominantly white district, red district, and it's all, and Democrats really don't have a chance in this district. Okay. But in Charlotte, that's a different story. But you got this Congresswoman Alma, something, her name like that. She's on Twitter talking about if the founding fathers, she was at an event in Charlotte at a town hall talking about gun control. Okay, we do need some measure of background, you know, universal background checks and stuff like that. There's no, you know, I think that there is reasonable ground to be found on that. But she was talking about, well, the founding fathers never didn't envision AR-15s when they wrote the Second Amendment. And I was like, just how ridiculous is that? The AR-15 wasn't, or the AK-47 is what she said, wasn't even invented at that time. So, of course, they didn't envision it. But if they had the AK-47, I'm sure they would have been passing it out to the slave patrols. You know, that woman needs to go, man. I've been watching her off and on. You know, again, it's not my district, but it's right across the river. And this is one of them useless black people in there, man. You know, they ain't really fighting for their constituencies like y'all have stated. So I think the Justice Democrats have shown, you know, thus far that you can get some of these people out of office by primarying them and raising up your own politicians that will run on the platform of justice, you know.
I know that here in Philly they have a few groups and they're of a particular slice that are organized at that level. That the challenge I have, and you kind of raising this, the challenge I'm having in relationship when it looks at blacks, that we're not organizing at that level. Mm-hmm. you know, and we don't have the kind of leadership, and I call it social capital, because it starts off, either you have the intellectual capital, you have the financial capital, or you have people out of the 60s who did it because they thought that this was the just thing to do. Mm-hmm. Whether they were in high school or in college, they didn't do it. They did it for principle. Now we don't have those kind of people who will move like they did to Mississippi to organize Mississippi. We can't get people to move out of their houses to organize within the neighborhoods they live in amongst Black people. Other than that, but we see what I'm calling immigrants or those who are gentrifying, they are the ones. And Justice for All, so are the Young Turks, because you look at the educational background of those guys, Harvard, Princeton, they're the ones that, and they're with AOC, you know, they're the ones that are part of organizing that level of the progressive wing, which was a part of the Bernie Sanders group.
Mm-hmm.
From that perspective, but in the Black community, among Black people, we're not. The constituency group is holding on to these the person like you described. I don't know even why those people vote for them.
Yeah, just simply because they're Black, man. You know, just simply because they're Black, and all skin folk ain't kin folk, man. I mean, if they're not running on a platform that's producing justice for our people or fighting for justice, because let's be real, you know, I've heard people try to shoot down some of our ancestors and say, well, what did they accomplish? Or we up against the most powerful, the richest white supremacists on the face of the planet, man. They've done the best that they could do with the resources that they had. But we have made some advances. You know, and we have to get smarter.
Yeah,
and just keep pushing forward. Now, the last thing I wanted to comment on was the Israeli lobby. That man's name is John Hagee. That's how you pronounce his last name. He's a racist. He had a slave auction in his church one time. Y'all don't remember that story? He's down there in Texas.
No,
the slave auction, man. I was like, wow. And so anyway, you know, one of my uncles, man, was just telling me, my aunt died that was in Detroit recently, a few months back. And so, you know, we all drove up there. We were in the van, so I had a chance to talk to him. And he was telling me, you know, how he felt like God had put on his heart to go to Israel. This was back in the 70s. And so he got on the plane, and my aunt, you know, who he was dating at the time, was saying, "You crazy." And she was saying, "I was telling him not to do it and all this and that." But he went anyway because he felt that strongly convicted. And I said, "Well, what did you do when you got over there? You know who he was hanging out with?" And said, "Treated him like he was family, the Palestinians."
Mm-hmm.
That's who he was hanging out with. And they was calling him a brother and all this and saying, "We're going to keep you, you know, and what have you." So, you know, what we have to do, though, is fight propaganda with the correct information. So let's say if we had a city council member or whoever, whatever position they may hold of elected office or even appointed office, and they're Black and they're coming at us with that stuff. Well, we need to be armed with information. We need to tell them, did you know that the Israeli government not only oppresses the Palestinians, since obviously you don't look at them as being human beings deserving of human rights, but look at how they treating the Ethiopian Jews. Mm-hmm. Who have been having their own Black Lives Matter movement, which, of course, is being ignored by Western media, but also point to Israel admitted to running a eugenics program to deplete the Ethiopian Jews, Black Jews population by giving these women, without their knowledge, Depo-Provera shots and telling them it was something else. And they cut their population in half in under 10 years, man. And Israel admitted to this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we have to be armed with, that type of information, you know, to confront these people when they come at us with that. Now, I posted in the chat room this article about from the Real News Network, which is based in Baltimore. Their flagship, it says Israel's flagship lobby organization collapses. They were some of the main, it was called the Israel Project. They are the ones who were really also going in. It wasn't so much AIPAC, not saying AIPAC wasn't, but it was this group. It was known as the largest and best funded pro-Israel NGO in the world, known as the Israel Project. It is now closing down, having run out of funding. They was like, remember, did y'all ever see that photo of, what's his name, Draymond Green of the Warriors, when he went on that trip to Israel and he posing with a rifle laying down, looking through the rifle like he gonna shoot some Palestinians or what? They were responsible for recruiting people like him. Shaka Khan, who I was really upset to know that she did that fundraiser for the Israeli defense forces.
Wow.
Yeah, she, you know, she was a Black Panther at one time, man, and so we just had to confront these people. But they're losing the propaganda battle here in the United States. You see that the U.S. government is now trying to pass in many of these states an anti-First Amendment. You can't lobby, you can't boycott. And I brought it up on Time for Awakening in the past with one of your guests. You know, where they're passing this anti-BDS legislation, mm-hmm. that says, oh, it's against the law for you to economically boycott Israel. Now, I mean, what kind of mess is that? That you willing to trash your own constitution for this nation of white supremacists? You know, they like to say that they are the only democracy in the Middle East. No. What they really mean is they are predominant white supremacist country in the middle of a bunch of brown people. Because like I tried to tell this dude the other day, man, Ashkenazi Jews are Germans. They are Europeans. They come from Europe. That's what Ashkenazi means. That's why they speak Yiddish. The number one spoken language in Israel is Yiddish, not Hebrew. It's Yiddish. What is Yiddish? Yiddish is a bastard language that's primarily German. That mixes in other languages. So we just have to keep fighting that propaganda, man, with the truth. But we got to know the truth in order to confront these people when they come at us with these lies. That's all I wanted to share, man.
Hey, thanks for that information, Scott.
Thank you.
Peace. Let's go to 215, Richard. 215. 215?
Hey, Brother Elliot.
How are you,
Brother Richard? How y'all doing?
All right.
Good.
Can y'all hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, it was good hearing from Brother Scotty and stuff. Elliot, before I talk about your subject matter, on Epstein, I know you were saying that Brother Warren Valentine said that Epstein would probably be found dead. And Elliot, I was shocked. Now, of course, you got to take it into context of them, because, you know, white folks, they like to play these games, because it was even on the conservative station, they were saying that it should be an investigation because Epstein had this list of well-known celebrities and politicians that may have engaged in this pedophilia acts with children. And first thing went through my mind, Brother Elliot, don't be surprised if 45's name might have been on there, you know what I mean? Because we know a 13-year-old white girl did accuse 45 of sexually assaulting her several years ago.
Well, he was friends with all of them, with Clinton and 45, a bunch of them. They were friends.
That's exactly. So that's what I'm saying. That wouldn't surprise me if it was a hit and stuff, because like I said, and now that he's dead, they're not going to see our way on bar them is doing window dressing when they send it. But that list of whatever he had is going to die with him. They're not going to reveal who these people was and stuff like that, because they know it could be Clinton's name could be on it. It could be, like I said, 45. It could be a whole bunch of these people's names. So it's going to die with them. All they're doing is grandstanding. But see, again,
they know who names are on it. You know,
oh yeah, they already know.
Part of the public, it might not be a part. It might not come apart as a cogent part of the public mind, right. Our information. But we know, to what degree? Because it gets into a whole lot of other things when you're talking about, you know, not. I mean, whether it be the Catholic Church or the whole thing of, pedophilia as far as trade with other countries, going into these island countries and getting these young children that have sex We're talking about the sexual rituals that, right, that goes on at this particular quote unquote elite. And so, and then the criminal culture that is involved. Oh, they know. Now, the question we may not know is what segment of them said, if he didn't fake it, right, what segment of them said it's time for him to go. But as
exactly, far as
the names, everybody know the names but us.
And see, Richard, and I'll say this last part before I move on to Israel. See, Brother Bobby Dick Gregory said on Terrestrial Radio several years ago, Martha Mitchell, who was the wife of John Mitchell, was Nixon's attorney general at the time. Now, they show you how these people, how they're so wicked, how they plan things ahead. She said back in 1973, I think it was, she says that she was talking to some reporters from the Washington Post or whatever. She flipped it with the mouth. She was saying, well, you know, they're going to, I'll be listening on my husband's cabinet meetings with the president, and they're going to bomb the World Trade Center 20-something years from now. Remember, the first bombing was in 93, and she says they're going to blame it on the Muslims. And, of course, that's what happened. The first one was in 93, and she was making all kinds of accusations and stuff, and she wound up being found dead. And lastly, it was a white lady. I can't think of her name. One of the programs to come on TV called What's My Line? To come on back in the day called What's My Line?
Mm-hmm.
Her name was Dorothy. I can't think of her last. But anyway, she said point blank, Ellie, and Richard, she didn't say that she was guessing. She said, I'm going to call a news copy. I'm going to reveal the people, the actual people that had President Kennedy killed. She said it straight up, Ellie. Maybe you heard me what I'm saying. She said, I know who was the person responsible for killing President Kennedy. Guess what? The next day or two, they found her dead in her hotel room of a drug overdose. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't make these things up. I think her name was Dorothy Gail Rodden, something like that. She's black, because she used to be on this show called What's My Line. And she was friends, at one time, she was good friends with Frank Sinatra and people like that. Well, anyway, like I said, the woman, she never got a chance to have that news conference. They found her dead in the hotel room of a drug overdose. I mean, these people, boy, they play for keeps, bro. These are some wicked, cold-blooded people. They play for keeps. But anyway, on Israel, you know, like I said to you and Richard several times, Brother Elliot, and you started with how they were going to these college campuses, and even some black colleges, trying to recruit these black young men and women, as well as these black churches. See, you have a large segment of black folks in this country. They support Israel from a book they biblically ignorant. Because these black preachers that they go to see every day and get their tithes and art and love offerings to, they brainwash our people. So you got sisters and brothers who are well-meaning, but they, like you said, Hosea says we suffer from lack of knowledge. So they look at these Ashkenazi Jews, as Brother Scotty said, they look at them as the chosen people of God, not realizing that their own black folks are the chosen people of the book. So they look at these Europeans as the chosen people of God, because they brainwashed. But then you got other Negroes, like the Barack Obamas of the world, who know better, but they just go along with it because they're too cowardly to tell the truth. But you got a large segment of our people, and I do believe, Ellen Richard, if a lot of these young black men and women, they go to these black churches, if they could get the right knowledge, that's why the clip that you played, Ellen, if they could get the right knowledge, they wouldn't think that way about Israel. But again, they have to have the right information, because like Dick Gregory said, information is powerful. If they get the right information, they'll look at Israel in a whole totally different light. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's basically what it comes down to. A lot of them, they biblically ignorant and stuff. Don't make them bad people that don't know no better and stuff, you know? And like I say, Israel, forget about that rabbi who last year referred to black people as monkeys using the Talmud as his justification. Remember Moshe Dayan, the former Israeli high-ranking official who had the patch on his eye. He made a racist comment several years ago where he said that if we run the United States is a weak country, it never be strong because they got too many blacks. They need to get rid of the blacks in their country. Moshe Dayan. So all these black folks that support Israel, I wish a lot of them don't even know that you got a racist Jewish rabbi that look at them as monkeys. You got a former Israeli prime minister, Moshe Dayan, that said that this is why America is not the country it could be because you got too many blacks in it. I wonder how they would feel if they knew these people said these things. You know what I mean? Again, lack of knowledge and not having the right information and stuff, like they say, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. So, I mean, we got to educate our people, like you said, Ellen Richard. We got to educate our people and get our people the right information. And like you said, the kids, to hold these black elected officials accountable, the Dwight Evans of the world, the Jordan Harris's, hold these niggas. I'm talking about locally. I mean, John Lewis, too, because like Brother Scott, he echoed my sentiments. John Lewis is a disgrace. Now, here's a man that's supposed to have been a protege of Dr. King, but he's pro-war, pro-police, pro-Israel. I mean, he got to go. And I've been saying this before. I said, he need to go. Like Brother Scott, he said, somebody need to run a credible candidate against him the next time he come up for re-election and get him out of there. He got to go. You know, we got to start getting rid of these people. That's what AOC was able to do in New York. You got a coalition of black and brown people, and this white guy that had been there for so long as a congressman, they got their coalition together, and they primaried him, and they got his behind out of there. And we got to do the same thing with John Lewis. He got to go, man. He has got to go. And we have to go around the country, whether it's in Philadelphia, whether it's in New York, and get rid of these people that's not doing our people no good, that's sitting back here instead of supporting their own people. Like you said, instead of looking out for the interests of black people, they're looking out for the interests of a foreign government. I don't care about no damn Israel. I want you as a black representative, whether you're in the city, state, or federal level, to look out for the interests of black people. I want you to try to make sure our schools stay open in the community and our schools is well-funded. We have books and computers for our children. You know, we can have job training for our children. I don't care about what you say about Israel. If you like Israel, that's your business. But damn it, we elected you to look out for us. No, we didn't elect you to look out for Israeli interests. And we got to start holding these people accountable. That's the bottom line, you know. But anyway, I ain't going to hold you. I just want to thank you and Richard for letting me get my comments. And then that's all I wanted to say, and I'm out.
All right, now.
Thanks, Brother Elliot. Thanks, Brother Richard.
All right, now.
Richard, it was an interesting discussion with the folks that came on. I mean, Scotty brought some valuable pieces of information there that some of them I'd forgot about a couple of them pieces that he had mentioned. But it's good to have. You got to be armed with information when you're dealing with these people. He's absolutely right there.
Definitely. Got to bring it down to make the connection to where we can show how the international specifically
these
international nations and relationships that are being fostered affects the local, and how that local affects people individually, personally, in their personal lives. We have to be armed with the information to make that connection there, because when people think that it's over there and it has nothing to do with them, or those politicians that don't talk about it because it's over, they get to go to travel over there. And if they don't, people on the ground don't get to see that there is somebody in the local area who is supporting that, not just the politician, but also supporting how directing the funds away from them, or directing the quality of life away from them, who is supporting the quality of life while at the expense of other people someplace else. Well, and it's, you know, I think that level of connection helps people be armed of how they can talk to each other in the barbershop, in the laundromat, standing on a corner, because they can make it personal to their particular life. Right now, everything seems at a distance. I think that's where the battle, when we talk about the battle for our minds, the minds of our people, we have to realize that we have to make it personal to their experience.
Yeah, you know, and that's why when you hear this stuff come up, like this president made the statements against Cummings, Clyburn. What was it, Cummings or Clyburn?
Cummings.
Against Cummings about Baltimore. Well, in reference to Baltimore, in reference to the district he represents, not necessarily against Cummings because he don't live like that, but against the district that he represents. And when we talked about it on the program, see, it's federal dollars that, not only federal, state and local dollars, and from the tax base that's in these cities. And black folks have a certain amount of power where they can redirect these monies. and they don't, and the people don't hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. I'll give an example, Richard. When Obama first went into office, and he had that his program, and I forgot what he labeled it, because all of them got this little label that they put on it, just like Trump put that label on it, and allocated $1.5 trillion. At the time, the guy that's now the current congressman was the state representative, Evans. Mm-hmm. And he was over the Appropriations Committee. He was the Appropriations Chair in the state of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. Now, his office is in the 7200 block of Ogunsa Avenue, for the people that's familiar with Philadelphia. I'm down at the 5900 block. So he comes down, because he always touted how he did so much for Ogunsa Avenue, which is a commercial black district. But he was only talking, for people that don't know, he was only talking about the block where his office is. Mm-hmm. There's several black businesses up there, but that's only in his block. All those other, all up and down Ogunsa Avenue, commercial district, it's Latino and Asian businesses. It's black sprinkled in all around. I'm talking about sprinkled in. It's no other districts in these ethnic communities where you got a ethnic business district that don't have the ethnicity of that neighborhood that that controls those businesses. Well, anyway, he came down there to my place. He comes in and talked about all the money that's going to be allocated for the black businesses. So, listen, I'm excited. Then he comes back a couple of weeks later. And he told me he was when he was coming, but he didn't tell me he was coming on the day he did. We were busy that day. So he comes in and he had people there, photo op. And, you know, some people, you know, in Philadelphia area got different thoughts about him. So he comes in and takes pictures, sits in the chair, and asks me to put the drape on him like I'm doing. You know, he wears his hair bald, so it was just a photo op. And then he leaves, but he leaves the number with my place, and there's a young lady that runs a daycare down the block about, you know, the money that's involved and the money that's going to be allocated for signage, for new windows, brick face, anything on the outside. Mm-hmm. You're responsible for what's going on inside, but anything on the outside, they was going to, you know, do it to kind of beautify the businesses in the area, make them more attractive. If you got money, if I got money for the businesses, you won $100,000 in the lottery, Richard. It's just a photo op. Mm-hmm. Where was the money? But I do look and see other businesses has been developed. I remember distinctly, Richard, and I know you remember it clear. Clinton came here when he won his second term. And you know where he went. Because at the time, he went to another commercial district here in Philadelphia, 52nd Street, which was traditionally a black commercial district. He went there at the time, Richard, and you remember he went to, what's the restaurant?
Big George.
Big George. That beautiful restaurant that was on the corner of 52nd and Locust. Two levels, plenty of seating in there, had excellent food. People from all over the city was coming to go to Big George's. You remember?
Yeah.
So he went to Big George's, never forget it, for a photo op, took black politicians and all over there. And that was to promote his program, where it was all these trillions of dollars coming into urban areas. And he was using Big George as a poster boy for it, Big George Restaurant. He went over there and sat down there. They had fried chicken, whatever they was eating. Took pictures and everything. The Big George restaurant is closed. Mm-hmm. I think the only one that has it is the rats that run all around in the vacant building. That building is closed. No money ever came to that restaurant. No money ever came to that commercial district. And that commercial district is run now basically by Asians. That whole 52nd Street corridor. So that's what I'm talking about. So when this guy gets on there and says, look at your district, this, that, black folks need not feed into that junk about, oh, he's a racist. Who cares? Everybody know that guy's a racist. But it is money that comes into those districts that's allocated for the districts that black people never get. And they never develop new businesses. You should have countless numbers of businesses that's developed all the time in black areas. You look, one or two businesses developed each year. Are you kidding me? So that's part of what Scotty was talking about. We got to come on with the information when we confront these people. Because they'll come with a snow job, and for people that don't know what's going on, they'll believe it.
True that. True that. And it's, you know, the challenge is, as you say, to get us, when you look at it from the perspective of sovereignty, sovereign thinking, and the perspective of repair, and what we have to do at the ground level, you know, which is to change, and where you started about changing the mindset, because in changing the mindset, we change the behavior. And right now, in order to combat the things that we're raising, it seems to me, well, our behavior has to be more unified than ever. Than ever. Because the onslaught of the, if you use the term competition, is going to be more intense than ever. Because the way they're creating this reality is that it don't need a whole lot of us to work their thing. Going in split, they needed a lot of us to work their thing. Today, they don't need a lot of us to work their thing. And as you describe, the people who are coming in, call immigrants, they're working their thing.
Yeah. They just need
they a ain't few. Working. They ain't working. I mean, they to come in as skilled workers. And if they don't have to build their places, which they get to use farm labor or whatever, they are working and building. They're buying these houses because they have already have the social capital to pull their money together to buy the $17,000 house. They also have the carpentry skills, electrical skills to be able to work and build that house. And then the social skills to live with each other. They're telling us through the whole immigration pack, and that's for the ones coming from the Southern Hemisphere. We ain't even talking about the ones that's coming through those H-1B-1 grant visas that are overstaying. You don't hear nothing about.
Richard, we got a couple on here. Let's go to 930. What do you think?
Okay.
Let's go to 470. 470? What's your name? Where you calling from, brother? Or what's your name? Where you calling from? 470? Let's put them back on hold. Maybe they stepped away. Let's go to 646. 646?
Yeah, what's up, Richard and Elliot? Right quick. Scotty was talking about H.R. 40. Now, from my understanding, I've heard that H.R. 40 is supposed to be rewritten through some people in association with Brother Sandy Darity and some others, because you know I hear a lot of people talking in regards to and COVID and all this and that, but you know, if the truth be told, I don't know what they really doing. I'm gonna be even more frank. After 40 some years, now all of a sudden it look like you're doing something. To me, that don't sound too right. You know?
No, I'm not following what you're saying. And you got something. You got a lot of stuff going on in the background. You got to turn some stuff down. It's causing interference, feedback. Go ahead.
Hold on one second. Yeah, they got the whole thing is, from my understanding, it's being rewritten. So, depending on how it's being rewritten, and if they do have 100 people, that's a good thing. But, I mean, if they're talking about that bill being introduced and as it being the bill.
Well, H.R. 40 was rewritten.
Reparation.
H.R. 40 was rewritten. It was a study in the beginning, but this new bill is not about a study. It was rewritten.
Yeah, but this
I ain't talking about. Listen, I'm not talking about people that's talking about they want to rewrite stuff. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the people that have done work. To September 12th, MBUF, and Cobra, members of the Nation of Islam. These are work that has been done by people. That historic work that's been done by other folks that have trailed. But I'm not talking about people that come along talking about, oh, people ain't been doing nothing. I ain't talking about all them Johnny come latelys. When some of the work was being done, some of these people that you're talking about was running around, who knows, maybe in school and playing in the schoolyard, playing with dolls. I don't know what they were doing. Playing baseball. I don't know what they was doing.
Elliot, let's be clear on something. Let's don't get caught up in a bunch of Negroes who've been around supposedly doing something.
I ain't getting caught up in no Negroes doing something.
Being presented is garbage. The bill is garbage. Let's play that game, please.
Wait a minute. Garbage. Have you been involved with any of those groups? We done talked about this before now.
No, we done talked about this before.
How many groups have you been involved in? How many groups have you been involved in?
I will answer the question. I will answer the question. The bill that you are talking about is being rewritten.
Let me finish. Jay, the only thing I ask is that, see, because when you say that, you're not talking about the legislative process. You can't just say it's being rewritten.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I told you.
H.R. 40 is already in at a certain point. Now, another bill can be written, then it has to go through the legislative process, which is to go through the committee, get enough committee signatures in order to come out.
This is why we as a people get caught in a situation and used by the John Lewis's and the rest of the people. Because of the simple fact, when we present garbage to our oppressor does nothing but take the garbage and use it as a tool to put a foot in our behind.
What garbage?
And I'm saying to you,
what garbage?
The bill is garbage. The bill is garbage.
You read it?
The H.R. 40.
Tell me some things that you see on there that's garbage.
And it's garbage.
Tell me some things you see on there that's garbage.
I don't have the bill in front of my face.
Well, get it. Listen, I'll tell you what you do. I want you to. Hey, you can't overtalk me. I'll put you on hold. What I want you to do is get the bill, and next week, Friday or whatever, you want to come on, and you point out the things that are garbage in the bill. That would be better to do because you don't have the bill in front of you. So throwing out blanket statements about stuff as garbage is just you're doing yourself a disservice. You ain't doing nobody else a disservice. You're doing yourself a disservice.
What I'm saying is.
Well, I know what you're saying.
The bill had some issues, and I will definitely do that. I may not do it this week, but I'll definitely do it by the following week.
Oh, no problem.
And if I may add, because I think that in our, you know, loose language about the legislative process, also, you know, hold us accountable, you know, in our dialogue of what's the process a bill, any bill has to go through. So even when it has to be rewritten, what is the process that it has to go through in order to be rewritten
let me say this also. What's so suspect about it is, and what really, really annoys me is, that there's so much interest now in this bill because a group of individuals decided that they wanted to use reparations as a template to hold people who have oppressed us accountable. So now, here it is, you're going to have people who have a history of effing over us, manipulate and use us so that these dumb Negroes that we have in our community will go out there and vote for the Democrats. And then when it's all said and done, nothing will happen with the bill. And that's exactly what's going to happen because we have not placed ourselves in a position to hold those Negroes that are using us right now accountable. And I'm going on record right now to say that when it's all said and done, reparations, if a Democrat got into office, is going to be kicked out the door and something else is going to come up, just like Nancy Pelosi has treated the so-called squad and others. When it's not necessary to give us anything, they're not going to give us anything. So all of this is just a game, again, manipulating black folks so that they could give a vote to our over-oppressor. That's what the tragedy is. Because none of these people in the reparation movement are collectively working together with one another on the level that it should
be. That's not true. That's not true. No. You stop right there. That's not true. You can feel that way all you want to. That's not true. I done told you before because you don't listen. September 12th. No. Listen, I'm going to put you on hold. And let you come back if you don't quiet down. September 12th movement in Cobra, the members of the Nation of Islam and MBUF have been working on this thing long before they went to that World Conference on Racism. It ain't been no backbiting, no, you ain't doing nothing. You did it. Here lately, the past year or two, you found this group that popped up that talking about these people ain't been doing nothing. The spirit of Queen Mother Moore and others have been working on this thing for a number of years. So don't come on with this stuff about ain't nobody ain't working together. That's not true. The only one that ain't working is you. The only one that's not working is you, because you can join one of these groups. You can start a chapter in your city. You can join in with MBUF and Cobra. You got Charles Barron. You got Charles Barron in your city. You got Charles Barron in your city that works with these groups. Hey. You got Charles Barron and all in your city that works with these groups. Join in with Charles Barron. He's a conscious black politician. Join in with him. Don't just say that those people ain't doing nothing. That's not true.
You make it seem like I don't know December 12th. You make it seem as though I don't know.
I didn't say you don't know any. I said join in with him. Join in. Have you joined in with him? Have you joined in with him? You still ain't answered that. You still ain't answered that question.
I'm saying to you that I have supported certain things that December 12th has done and Charles Barron has done. What I'm also saying is, and I'll stand by it, is how it is now, after 40 years, you have a group that come along that start challenging you, start saying that maybe you should look at it this way and look at it that way, and they deem to be the enemy, and you won't even take the time out to sit down and see how we could all come together to do the necessary thing. That's all my critique is. So when you try to make it seem that my critique is broader than that, all I'm saying is, how could all of those groups attack one group and not figure out a way how they could sit down and talk to one another?
How could all of what group attack? That's misinformation. The other groups didn't attack that group. You got that backwards. Just like a lot of other points that you try to make. Wait a minute. Attacking one another. They were attacked by the group you're talking about. Those groups didn't attack that group. They were attacked by the group you're talking about. And why don't you join in with that group? If they're doing something that you deem as...
I just told you.
You told me what?
You're not interested.
Then what are you talking about? If you're not interested in it, then what are you talking about?
I'm talking about it because of the simple fact that if something is done right and done collectively, then it could be...
But you're not interested in it.
...that is not being taken advantage
but
of.
But you're not interested in it. Well then, okay.
Talk about the
New York Knicks or something like that. Baseball.
No,
talk
I'm
about
not,
something
I'm,
else.
I'm
then.
I'm not talking about.
Well, don't talk about a subject that you're not interested in.
But the point of the matter is, you know what's so sad is that we look for situations that's going to try and move us forward as a people, and those situations always is predicated on one thing. The goddamn white man giving us some. That's all it's predicated on. You're not even placing yourself in the position to do anything to that white man when he don't give you what you want.
Who did the damage?
And that's the tragedy of it.
Who did the damage?
That's the tragedy of it.
Who did the damage?
Who did what damage?
Wait a minute. Who did you just say? Who did you just say?
I'm saying, who did what damage?
If I stole something from you.
We all know the white man that did the damage.
Okay. All right, then.
What damage are you
going to do? Is he responsible for being involved in any of that repair? Is he responsible? You gonna answer the question and you ain't gonna go back and forth like this. Is he responsible in repairing any of that damage he created? Historical damage over hundreds of years. Is he or is he not responsible for repairing that damage? Yes or no? Yes or no? You what? Say it again so the listening audience can hear it.
I would have to say yes.
Okay, now wait a minute. Now, I don't want you to keep on talking because sometimes you convolute the issues. If he is, then we need to hold him responsible, and that's what those groups are doing. I'm glad that you see that this man, who's the be-all and end-all sometimes when you talk about him, is responsible for that damage that he's created among our people. He's responsible for it. And he need to be held accountable for it. That's what those groups are trying to do. And they've been trying to do it. In their way. Now, you got other groups that have come along.
Did I ever say that he wasn't responsible? But did I also not say that you have to place yourself in a position to make him responsible and held accountable for his actions? And
Let me ask you something. Have those groups that you've been critical of, have they placed themselves in a position where they can hold him somewhat more accountable than you? Yes or no?
What group are you talking about?
What group have you been talking about? Come on, man. We're not going to play these games. We're not going to play these games.
I'm asking you
what group were you talking about? What groups?
As far as I'm concerned.
You wasn't talking about none of them?
None of them have placed themselves. I'm saying none of them have placed themselves in the position to hold the white man accountable.
Oh, they haven't.
That's what I'm saying. None of them. Near one of them.
All right.
And that's just a fact.
What would they have done in order to do that?
I would have to say that's the $1,000 question. But one thing they would have to do is collectively come together and settle all of their beef. And once they settle their beef, then move forward.
Who got beef? What are you talking about? Who has beef?
What are you talking about? Don't get. Telling me that these ADOS.
Now you're talking about some Johnny come lately. Hey, man, listen here. I'm not talking about no Johnny come lately. I told you that these groups that have historically been working on this thing, and you keep mentioning their names. Let me repeat it for you so it'll sink in. That's members of the Nation of Islam, the December 12th Movement, MBUF, and NCOBRA have historically been working on this. Go back and look at history of Queen Mother Moore and others. Do a little research. It ain't no goddamn ADOS. Ain't no ADOSs around when these things have been working on. When they went to the World Conference on Racism, it wasn't no ADOS there. I want you to understand this.
Let's be clear. When ADOS and challenged it, then what happened?
Challenge what?
For ADOS coming on the scene, you wouldn't even be talking about no goddamn reparations.
Hey, listen here. I've been talking about reparations on this program since Time for Awakening has been on.
Elliot, I know you have.
So what are you talking about? Was that long before ADOS? Hey, man. Hey, hold it. Hold it. We've been talking about this issue of reparations long before there was any ADOS out here. So I don't know what you're talking about, but I know what we've been doing, not talking, what we've been doing. And that's the problem. It's too many talkers and not enough doers. And again, if you want to talk about this issue, get H.R. 40, point out the things that you claim are garbage and bring them to the air, and we'll talk about it. And maybe I'll bring Cam Howard or somebody on there so they can go back and forth with you in reference to something that is garbage in that bill. Because you haven't been instrumental in helping these men. These men have been screaming about people volunteering and help them in the different cities. If you don't want to join in with Charles Barron and them, come down to Philadelphia. It's only 2 hours away from you. You can join in with Brother Ari and them. They need people to join in with the group.
And my I take a different tone on this, Wells, too. But the point of the strength and weakness of H.R. 40 is one issue as far as, but the question that I find our dialogue get mixed up is in the legislative process. And that's one. And then the generational, generational discussion that is around the issue of reparations is two. And then the third question of, well, you know, what is it that we, not necessarily what are we going to be given, but what is repair? What is the process that we have to do in order to repair ourselves, regardless whether the governmental process works or not? That's three. And to me, the language gets into a soap opera kind of, back and forth, because it's not based in a legislative process has a certain way a bill has to go through. If somebody else sees that the bill that is going through is not correct based off of what they see, then they have to create another bill and take it through the legislative process. That they can't go to the bill that's already in.
Yeah, I know it. Yeah. So
create another bill in order to go through it. So that's, and even if they do can go through the bill that's already in, it still has to go through a process to do that. So that part is like really, that's not helpful in us becoming informed of how the legislative process works. And the question about intergenerational dialogue, if our intergenerational dialogue is young versus old, and the old saying the old is saying, well, we've been putting in the work, and that becomes contentious, then we still haven't figured out how do we communicate between generations. That is something that we have to work out. That's internal. That has nothing to do with the media or the legislative process. That has to deal with our cultural communication process. Because if we can have an intergenerational dialogue, even if it's of difference, then we can't do anything. We in relationship to a state, to a culture that has been anti to us all along. And then the third thing is, as I said, it seems to me, and I agree on this point, we need to have a structure. And again, I've always said, and I've only seen two, and it may have been more, well, three. If we go to the 19th century, those Negro conventions, they had different points of view and different generations sitting around. They were the basis. You always talk about Eliot as far as after the Civil War. Black people got their political teeth sharpened by those Negro conventions, by having those different points of view. Coming into the 20th century, I'll just deal with the Black Power Movement. It was the Black Power Movement. And when we talk about Israel, it was all of those different points of view. Eventually, people went to jail and died to have those Black Power conferences. They had people from the gangs, from the street. They had gangsters. They had the few electoral politicians at the time. They had the cultural nationalists, the socialists, the communists. They eventually came together, and it broke down over the issue around Israel. It broke down in 72. It broke down around that. So, but today, where is that mechanism? Where is that mechanism? No, and if we had that mechanism, then all, not just the coalitions that are supporting each other, but the the mechanism where the ones who don't support sit at the table and we can have intelligent scientific discussion, negotiation of how we are going to move, even if it's going to be moving on different fronts, an agreement, mutual agreement, that that's how it's going to move. We don't have that today. So in this medium, we don't have that. And what we have is this nonsense, which the entertainment industry takes advantage of it. I mean, you go to Housewives. I mean, I don't watch it, but the Housewives of Atlanta and all those shows, listen to how they talk. They arguing over each other. And who is making the money out of that? This is black folks.
Yeah.
So does that enrich us moving or repairing ourselves? No. So we definitely need to figure out how do we communicate in this medium to where we can have mutual agreement and disagreement and be able to problem solve. If we don't, we're just feeding into some venue that making other people a living, but it's not solving our problem. As I said, and it seems history might support that, you know, in my arrogance.
Yeah, it's, you know, it.
Can I be heard?
Is this 470?
Yes, no, it is.
Yeah, I want you to. I came to you 15 minutes ago. You gotta be ready to speak. What's your name, brother? Where you calling from?
Yeah, this is Brother Jeff down here in Atlanta, Georgia.
I'm sorry. Okay, how you doing, sir?
That's all right. How you doing? I'm doing well. How you doing, Brother Elliot?
Good.
And Brother Richard, how you doing, brother?
Great. How you doing now?
Great. Yeah, I'm doing well. Well, I just had to add my little two cents to the discussion when the discussion was on the politicians prior to the discussion with Brother Jake. I just think the way we hold these politicians accountable is that all the businesses with community required that 15% of their profits stay within that community. And those funds should be going directly toward black businesses in that community. Let's replace those Chinese, those Koreans, or those Arabs that are doing business in our community. We need to replace them with business of our own. And the way that we do it, to hold all those corporations, all the people that's sucking all the resources out of our community, to hold them accountable, is to make sure that those businesses in those communities to hold a percentage of their profit, and that profit should stay within that community. You know, and that would just be something else that could be added on to the discussion about reparations. That could be a piece of it. They're going to still do business in our community. We need to retain some of that profit that they make out of our community, and that profit should be going towards some type of business that operate within, I mean, so we can operate business within our own community. So I just had to throw that out there, and that's a process that I'll be working with the brother that's here in Atlanta to be working on that aspect of the reparations, is to be able to hold these politicians, get them to be on board with holding these people that's accountable, and keep those funds within our community. Some of those funds back into our community, build our own businesses. You know, so I just had to add that in, brother.
Okay. When you mentioned about the advent of holding them accountable, when these businesses come into the community, and I know that Atlanta's no different than Philly. Mm-hmm. It's political. They have to go through a lot of these representatives, whether they call themselves aldermen, council people, whatever, and they mm-hmm. have to get zoning. You have to go in front of people, and generally it's a political mm-hmm. body, and say, well, I want to open up a sneaker store, a dress shop, we selling sunglasses, a beauty supply. You gotta go to them and let them know what you want to do. And then generally, they'll put it before some type of zoning hearing. So these businesses can't even come into the community unless they get approval from black leadership.
Well, and I'm saying, but those politicians that's in place, we need to require that that before they allow business into our community, it's understood that 15% of their profit stays within that community. We need to set up funds in the different communities where these people got that money flows into black businesses, that we can open the business in our community. Let us service our own people.
Okay.
So that would be a way that we can hold those politicians accountable and make sure that you sitting there, you letting these people come in and start a business in there. This is the requirement, that 15% of their profit stays within their community. And that's across this country. Because coming out of Wisconsin and coming down here in Georgia and seeing the same thing over and over again, they come in here and they pump these businesses in our community, and they just sucking the money out and they give nothing back. So we got to hold the politicians who allow these businesses to come into it and make that be a requirement. That before a business is opened up, they must agree that 15% of their profit stays within their community. And that's what I just wanted to add to the discussion, guys.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot. Peace. All right, sure. Peace.
Richard, we got about a couple more minutes. Let me go back, because I think that Scotty, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Did you want to say something in reference to?
I want to say in reference to two things: accountability and HR 40. On the accountability issue, how do you hold, for example, if I lived in let's say John Lewis District? How would I hold this man accountable? The only way I feel that he can be held accountable is the primary he's behind. Because simply not showing up to vote is only going to ensure that a worser person gets in from the Republican Party. So me staying home in a temper tantrum and not turning out to vote is not me holding anybody accountable. John Lewis is going to retire and live out the rest of his life in luxury. He ain't being held accountable just simply because he lost to a Republican. To hold them accountable is to primary them and put somebody in there that's going to be accountable. Also on the issue of accountability, sometimes I pronounce names wrong. Joaquin, I believe, is how the Castro brothers, one of them running for president, the other one is a Congress member down there in Texas. I like what he did. He put on blast all of those businesses and people who maxed out donations to the Trump campaign and put them on blast, like Kenny Stills did to the owner of the Dolphins.
Exactly.
He's like, wait a minute. You're going to start a nonprofit talking about equality and justice, and then you're going to hold a fundraiser for one of the racist commander in chief? Oh, no. And now what's happening? People boycotting that man's businesses. That's how you hold these people accountable. I like the idea the brother was talking about, but aren't there taxes that these businesses pay already supposed to stay in the community?
It's supposed to. And the politicians are supposed to make sure it does.
I believe that the money is there, it's just being misappropriated. Okay? Like, for example, I bring Baltimore up as an example. I remember reading during the winter months, those kids having to wear their winter coats in class because the heat didn't work. But the city of Baltimore built a multi-million dollar youth detention facility instead of fixing a boiler in those schools. So, you know, so those are my thoughts on that. On H.R. 40, listen, I got issues with H.R. 40, but guess what? I'm not going to trash it because I ain't putting nothing for it. And I ain't put in the work to lobby these politicians and whatnot. We got to understand how politics work in this country. A lot of people have a simplistic view. They just say, well, what do you need to do a study for? Just cut the check. Well, that's not how politics work in this country. Before they fund anything, they have what's known as committees. Whether you want to call them study committees or whatever, they study the issue, then they come up with proposals. I have H.R. 40 up in front of me. I posted it in the link. It says to address the fundamental injustice, cruelty, brutality, and inhumanity of slavery in the United States and the 13 American colonies between 1619 and 1865, and to establish a commission to study and consider a national apology and proposals for reparations for the institution of slavery, its subsequent du jour and de facto racial and economic discrimination against African Americans, and the impact of these forces on living African Americans, to make recommendations to Congress on appropriate remedies and for other purposes. Now, the only thing I got an issue with that is it shouldn't end in 1865. You know why it shouldn't end in 1865? The time period that they're covering, because slavery has not been abolished.
Mm-hmm.
See, they're operating off of the myth that the 13th Amendment abolished slavery when it in clear English. Anybody that can comprehend English, I would say on the eighth grade level, or if you know the definition of accept, which where it says we are abolishing voluntary servitude and slavery except as a punishment for crime. Well, then what do you think mass incarceration is or convict leasing is? That's the continuation of slavery in a different format.
Mm-hmm.
So it never ended. It's ongoing. And that's why I like the study that the committee at the UN level did, that said, wait a minute, they owe not just for slavery, but for Jim Crow and for continued police violence and everything else that's impacting us. Okay, so that's my only issue with H.R. 40. The intent is great. My main issue is why stop at 1865? Okay, why stop there? Then also, I don't like, and this is why I say, people, this bill is not going to pass while Trump is in, or even if the House passed it right now. It's very unlikely that the Senate would take it up, even though it has been introduced in the Senate. It's still under the control of Republicans. Then you got Donald Trump sitting there who had to sign it into law. It's not going to happen. All right. So although I do agree that the work still needs to be done and the momentum built in getting the co-sponsors, realistically, it won't be passed until after Trump is out of office, and then depending upon which party is in control. Republicans don't even talk about reparations. And I just have to ask the question of why is it that this one certain group only talks about the Democrats? The Democrats ain't done nothing. The Democrats ain't going to do this or do that. Well, what about the Republicans? You think they going to do it? They ain't even talking about it. I don't think there's one single Republican co-sponsor of H.R. 40 or one Republican who was on record. You see what they did with their witnesses, because all the people on that recent committee or that, what would we call that? What we call that? The hearing on H.R. 40. Mm-hmm. We saw what Republicans did with their witnesses, because each one got to invite a witness. What did they do? They invited anti-reparations black folks. Okay, so if reparations going to pass, it's going to have to go through the Democratic Party. And for all its shortcomings, and it has many, the fact is we live in a two-party system where two parties control the whole process. So if it's going to pass, it's going to go through the Democrats. Now, the only other issue I have with it is how the commission, if it was to be set up, let's just say, for example, it was to pass right now, and Donald Trump said, okay, I'm a pander to black folks because people putting pressure on me, even though I don't see nobody putting pressure on him, for reparations, because certainly Candace Owens and them ain't talking about it and trying to get the Republicans to do it. But let's just say, you know, in bizarro world, that it does pass while Trump is in office and he signs it into law. Well, I also got an issue with how it's going to be picked. Three members shall be appointed by the president. That's going to be Donald Trump. Who do you think he's going to pick? Three members shall be appointed by the Speaker of the House of Representatives. That's Nancy Pelosi. She ain't really come out for reparations. One member shall be appointed by the president pro tempore of the Senate. I believe that's the vice president. Okay, right. That would be Mike Pence, right? Okay. Right. And then six members shall be selected from the major civil society and reparations organizations that have historically championed the cause of reparatory justice. So I got issues with the bill. I got some issues with the bill, but I'm not going to badmouth them and trash it And no, I'm going to do it in a constructive manner. You know what I'm saying? And so, like y'all was saying, well, if you don't like the bill, write your own bill, put in the work to find you a congressional sponsor. Then you need to find a bunch of sponsors. And that's a long process. So, you know, before I shit on, I'm sorry, excuse my language. Before I take a crap on somebody else's work, I better have put in the work and given them an alternative. You know what I'm saying? So I have issues with the bill, but you know what? Well, the reparations was going to pass or not. That's still not going to stop me from voting. Now, I heard you earlier mention that Bernie Sanders don't support reparations. Well, that's not exactly true. And I liked his earlier answers because he was like, I'm not just going to tell you what you want to hear. When you say reparations, what are you talking about? That could mean anything. When Warren said, when they asked him about Warren supporting H.R. 40, well, what does that exactly mean? Just saying you support reparations, well, what's the policy proposals? What's the reparative justice that you're talking about? So I appreciate his honest commentary on that. What are you talking about? Now, Danny Glover is part of his campaign, and I know they've been educating him on reparations because on Juneteenth, him, Bernie Sanders, and I just said his name, Danny Glover, who's been fighting for reparations on an international level and taking it to the UN and what have you, they put out a video together detailing that reparations is old. So Sanders has been brought, educated, and brought around to, he said, I will sign H.R. 40 into law. Again, H.R. 40 has some shortcomings, but he has committed himself to saying, if the Senate or if Congress passes it, I will sign it into law. But you know what? Like I was talking to my daughters and stuff. Even if he didn't support reparations and he somehow got the nomination, you know why I would still vote for him? Because the policies that he championed would help us disproportionately. I asked my sister is under crushing student debt. Sanders, the only one talking about, I will eliminate all that debt. All of it's forgiven. Would that help black people the most? I feel it would. Would free tuition at public colleges and university help black people the most? I feel it would. And he also said he support HBCUs and getting them extra funding. Would Medicare for All support black people with our disproportionate, you know, health outcomes? It would help us the most. So that's what I'm saying, man. Let me lower my voice. I can't stand it. Look, I'm against abortions, right? I personally do not support abortions, okay? But it's in law. So I ain't going to make no big deal out of it. But I do not want tax dollars, federal tax dollars, going to support abortions. That's where I draw the line. Okay, you want to go kill your baby, that's on you. Don't ask me for no money for it. Like a woman who said I got her pregnant asked me for money. I was like, wait a minute. I'm not giving you no money for no abortion. And I feel like taxpayers shouldn't be forced to vote for abortion. But I know people in my family, that's the only issue they vote on. Whether or not a person is, they will not vote for a pro-choice candidate. They don't care. They feel that strongly about the killing of babies that they'll vote for Donald Trump just because he says he's against abortions. I can't operate it like that because the world is not that simple. It's more complex than that. And politics is more complex than a lot of people seem to think it is. It's not as simple as saying, well, y'all know y'all did what y'all did, so cut the check. That's not how the legislative process works. Perhaps you need to be looking at a lawsuit and filing a lawsuit. And then there's even barriers to that, to the lawsuits, man. It's just a lot of work, man, that we got to do. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Okay, brother. Richard, interesting discussion, man, that we had tonight. And it's ongoing because these issues, they're here. They're in front of us. And we're going to be dealing with them in one way or the other. And whether we want to or not, we can't bury our head in the sand. I mean, we got to come up with strategies and solutions to deal with it. The one thing I do like about the traditional organizations that have been fighting, that they do come back and let you know step by step what they're doing.
Right.
They have meetings, whether they're sparsely attended or not, they still have meetings. They put out the word when they're going to have their meetings. They go through the agenda to let the public know exactly what's going on.
Elliot, one last thing you just reminded me that I wanted to share. And NCOBRA isn't one organization. It's an umbrella of organizations, right? That's correct, right?
Yes.
Right.
Right. Here's the thing, and you know, since we've been working with them to do a weekly program, I've become more informed about it. You know what I don't hear them doing? And I'm not just talking about NCOBRA. I'm talking about the other groups I've been exposed to because of NCOBRA. You know what I don't hear, see them doing on social media or any other time that they're talking about it?
Trashing.
They don't link it. They don't come on talking trash.
Exactly.
About Africans. They don't talk trash about immigrants. They don't tie it into any other issue. They stay focused on a single issue of getting reparations for us. Now, these other issues ain't got nothing to do with reparations, so why are you making it part of your platform?
Yeah, well, that's what I was telling our caller from New York about the trashing back and forth. Those organizations that has been traditionally fighting, they didn't bring up any trashing of anybody. They might have responded. Some individuals might have responded to the constant trash, but they didn't bring up any trashing about anybody's work, because several of them are working and been working together on this issue for a number of years.
Mm.
So, you know, and listen, go ahead, Richard.
I just, because you always hear me saying that, I just want to put out there, I'm one of those who's for the repair part is looking more from a nationalistic perspective, a Black nationalist perspective, in the sense of promoting and this is going through international law, but promoting Black people, promoting was now the term, the ones who's pushing for Afro descendants. And I know we have had some discussion because I would not saying going anywhere, but the area that we populate and control, we need to control those resources within that area, dictate and disseminate within that. But in order to do that, we have to declare ourselves as a people, which we're not compared to, you know, and I have a problem with going through the governmental legislative process, but I think that that's the remedy, and therefore the group that is or the proposal of process that's going on that dealing with that, you know, that's where I'm more partial in the discussion for reparations question from a perspective of self-repair and self-governance. And that's why you'll hear me always use the term sovereign thinking. I ain't saying we're at the point of sovereignty yet, but at least starting the process of sovereign thinking to move towards sovereignty.
I agree. Listen, before we leave tonight, let me kind of go over our lineup again on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, African Perspectives with Brother Oshi from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Always interesting discussion with Brother Oshi on African Perspectives. From 1 to 3, Black People's Matrix with Brother Franklin Jones. From 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed on Monday evenings on Time for an Awakening Media. And every first and third Monday is Conversation Reparations with NCOBRA from 9 to 10 on every first and third Monday on Time for an Awakening. And I'll kind of give you reminders during the week of our of their program. And from 10 to 12, a Warren Valentine Show Night Talk podcast on Time for Awakening. And that's weekly, Monday through Friday, from 10 to 12 on Time for Awakening Media. On Tuesday, 8 to 10, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers, from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media on Wednesday. Revive is here with Sister POC from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening on Thursdays. Relationships with Joy and Troy from 7 to 8 on Time for an Awakening Media. And on Fridays, Time for Awakening is back from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening Media. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. Children, soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of.
Save the children.